Eric Kimmel has written more than 50 children's books. These include Herschel and the Hanukkah Goblin, which has become one of the most beloved and popular books of the season, handed down from generation to generation. The Eric you find in his books is the same Eric I've counted as a friend for nearly 40 years. Witty, charming, engaging, and a wonderful storyteller. It's my pleasure to introduce my friend, Eric Kimmel, to you today. Eric?
Well, thank you for inviting me here today. I very seldom have a chance to talk to grown-ups, so I'm going to make the most of it. About a week ago, George and Tracy and I met for coffee to figure out what we're going to do. And Tracy said she would like me to talk about the mystery of Hanukkah. And I laughed. I said, oh, you want the fairy tale? Because this is a season that's full of fairy tales. Nice, pretty stories. And the one about the guy in the red suit with the reindeer sleigh isn't the only one. So let's start. About 55 years ago, when I was a freshman at Lafayette College in eastern Pennsylvania, Lafayette was Presbyterian related at the time, so we all had to take a year of religion. And the first semester was comparative religion, which I found very interesting. The second semester was Origins of Christianity, which I frankly was scared of because I didn't know anything. And I figured I'd start that class at a distinct disadvantage. But what I soon discovered after about the first couple of lectures is that my Christian friends didn't know any more about it than I did. Because all they had were the Sunday school fairy tales, which is what most people have. But I think it's time to remember the words of St. Paul. When I was a child, I spake as a child, but now that I am a man, I put away childish things. So, let's look at the story of Hanukkah without the fairy tales. Quick summary of relevant Jewish history. There's a lot of that. In 586, the Babylonian king Nebuchadnezzar burns the temple to the ground, Solomon's temple, and destroys the city of Jerusalem, carries most of the population of Judea off to Babylon, and there he pretty much leaves them alone. And they don't disappear. They had their own culture, their own religion, their own way of doing things. Then the Persian Cyrus comes along, overthrows the Babylonians, and he, in Jewish traditions, is a very good king because, again, he leaves them alone. And not only that, he appoints a Jewish governor of Judea and says, anybody who wants to go back can go back. So they go back and they rebuild the temple. It's certainly not as glorious as the one Solomon believed, but the religion is functioning again in its own place. Then Alexander the Great comes along and conquers the Persian Empire, and Alexander is a very positive figure in Jewish folk literature, again, because he leaves them alone. Alexander more or less says, as long as you pay your taxes, you can do whatever you want, but I have something you need to check out, and this is the Greek way. And the Greek way is like nothing anybody has ever seen before. You have beautiful art, beautiful sculpture, impressive ceremonies. You have philosophy, intellectual challenges. You have a new approach to divinity, which is, you know, you can worship all your little gods if you want, but remember, they're all manifestations of something that's bigger and better and infinitely, perhaps incomprehensible. And anybody can plug into this way of life. Doesn't matter what your background is. Learn Greek. Shave that ridiculous beard off your face. Style your hair in the Greek way. The door is open to anybody who wants to walk through. This is the future. And this is potent stuff. And in Judea, you have plenty of people who plugs into this. We can be Greeks too, and we can be part of this enormous, powerful world civilization. And then there are, well, I can't call them the rabbis because they're not rabbis yet. They're not even Jews yet. You call this the Judean religion, perhaps. You have the traditionalists who say, yes, all of this is fine. There's a lot to admire with the Greeks. But we have some positive things, too, that we don't want to see thrown out. And just like the early Bolsheviks in the 20th century, you Jewish Hellenists decide we need to move forward, and the traditionalists are not getting with the program. So maybe we're just going to have to use force. And they persuade, by this time Alexander's empire is broken up, they persuade the king of Damascus, the Seleucid monarch, Antiochus, that maybe he needs to put a little muscle behind the persuasion. And we have things happening that never happened in the pagan world before, because in the pagan world, what does it matter which god you worship? Athena is here, Zeus is down the street, go to one or go to both. But now we have forced worship. And we have the story of Hana and her seven sons who are killed one after another because they refuse to bow down to a Greek statue. This is martyrdom for the first time, which is a completely new concept, forcing people to worship a certain way, whether or not they believe in it or not. And this still isn't working, because when you create martyrs, you create resistance. So the Hellenists go one further. They said, cut off the religion at the roots, send soldiers, take over the temple in Jerusalem, and turn it into a pagan shrine. Now, they knew exactly what they were doing, and the implication of this is often missed when Hanukkah stories are told, because at this time there's no synagogue. There's no prayer book. These concepts don't exist. The way you approach God is through sacrifice. And the only place in Judea where you can sacrifice is in Jerusalem. So all of a sudden, there's no religion. You have no way of approaching the divine. And this is an in-your-face approach. What are you going to now do now? Either knuckle under or fight. And who are you going to fight? The armies of Alexander the Great? Suckers, we've got you. Except they didn't. Because as we learn in the 20th and 21st century, as we've learned in Afghanistan, Iraq, Vietnam, a huge, powerful army doesn't work when it faces people who disappear, who hide behind trees, in caves, who shoot arrows, throw rocks at you, who are there 1 minute and gone the next. Long, drawn-out, expensive wars. And you win some pitch battles, you lose others, and eventually it becomes more and more expensive. The game is not worth the candle. And after a big victory of the Judean forces in a place called Emmaus, the Greeks pulled back, they occupied fortresses in Jerusalem, but more or less left the city to the Judeans. The temple was cleansed, devoted to the service of God, and you hear the story of the little cruise of oil that lasted for 8 days. I recently glossed on that to put it in modern perspective. Imagine your cell phone has 10 minutes of life in it, and somehow it lasts all week. I think that's really pretty good. Okay, so this is wonderful. We have our temple, we have our worship, we have our country back. What can go wrong? Plenty. Because the leaders of this revolt, the Hasmonean family, decide they're going to rule as kings. And the traditionalists say, no, there's only one king in Israel, and that's the line of Solomon. You're not from that line. You need to step aside. And the Hasmonean rulers say, we're not stepping aside. We didn't fight to get out of the way and put some nobody on the throne. We're in the saddle now, and you better get used to it. And the Hasmoneans are a very difficult dynasty, and they go rapidly downhill after the Hanukkah victory. First of all, they rule as Near Eastern monarchs. Expensive luxuries, expensive wars, lots of interdynastic squabbles. They have whole harems, which means lots of sons to fight over the succession. And when you have a problem with your own people, they're not too happy with your rule, what do? Start a war. So imperialistic wars against easily defeated neighbors begin. One of the greatest, I shouldn't say greatest, but one of the ablest practitioners of this kind of realpolitik was the king Alexander of Janaeus, who conquered Edom, which is Edomia, which is, a community largely made up of Arabs, and also the Galilee, which was a very rural area with a mixed population, some Jewish, some pagan, that was off the charts and got along pretty well for most of the time. Forced conversion to Judaism is a very brutal act because it involves circumcision. So you think about this at the time before we knew about microbe sanitation. You're asking people to risk their life, and you're more or less forcing them to do it. So the traditionalists, again, I'm not going to say the rabbis at the time, did not like this dynasty one bit. They felt they were illegitimate. They felt they were sacrilegious. And they also felt that their politics were endangering the country, mainly because they got very cozy with another rising power called Rome that was moving into the area. And in fact, in their dynastic squabbles towards the end of their days, two of the princes, Hyrcanus and Aristobulus, invited the Romans to come in. And the Romans came in the side of Hyrcanus and stayed. And when he proved himself to be not as competent as they would hope, they moved him out of the way and appointed one of his ministers to rule the country, and his name was Antipater. And when he was assassinated, they appointed someone else, his son, who was called Herod the Great. Familiar name? Okay. So here we come to the two other fairy tales of the time, which is Galilee. Who comes out of Galilee? Well, Jesus, of course. And remember the long genealogy in Matthew that links Jesus to the house of David and the city of Bethlehem. In Jewish terms, at least in Jewish terms of the time, this was establishing his function as the Redeemer, the Messiah, linking him to the house of David. Because the traditionalists on the other side of the fence said, what are you talking about? He's a Galilean. He was probably a pagan if you go back two or three generations. So the story of the genealogy from David, the angels, the wise men, the camels, the sheep, everything in the Nativity is kind of like the cruse of oil that burns for 8 days. It's a pretty story. It focuses things, keeps the children interested, justifies things that are going to come later. But here's the truth. At this time, we don't need miracles, because the miracles, the real miracles of the season, are staring us in the face, and there are two of them. One, this completely insignificant ancient people that had the temerity to assume that the non-entity God they worshipped, that nobody ever heard of, not only was the only God who ruled the universe, but that this was the supreme God for all people to be worshipping. The nerve. And yet this tiny, insignificant, arrogant people is still here. Centuries and centuries and centuries, and even the industrialized tyrannies of the 20th century cannot erase them from the map. And here's the other miracle that goes with the season. This one man who comes out of nowhere, a complete nobody, who may well have been illiterate or semi-literate, and his gang of followers, hardly ever more than a handful, who come from the lowest levels of society. And if they lived here in Portland today, would probably be eating at a soup kitchen or camped out under an overpass. That this man who never wrote anything, and all we have from him are fragments of whatever it was he was teaching, through the force of his personality and his message, changed the course of Western history, and is the reason why we're here today. So you look for the miracles of Hanukkah and the Christmas season. There they are, looking at the face. You don't need fairy tales, and you don't need the guy in the red suit. But it's fun. Enjoy. Thank you.
Thank you, Eric. And now is the time for all ages. So the children, some of them are already forward here. Well, the other children, please come forward, and Eric will lead our time together.
The words I just said were kind of heavy stuff, so we've got to lighten it up. This is one of my favorite stories called Hanukkah Bear. It's like in its second version. And this story comes out of...
by Eric Fimmel.
Yeah. Ta-da. This story comes out of things I used to love when I was a kid. Number one, I love Mr. Magoo cartoons. Remember Mr. Magoo? Well, for those of you who aren't old enough to remember Mr. Magoo, the joke there was Mr. Magoo is very nearsighted, and he can't see, so he wanders into all sorts of dangerous situations, like he walks into the lion's cage or over a waterfall or across the freeway. And he's never terrified because he doesn't really know where he is. And he comes through okay. I thought those cartoons were terribly funny. And then the second thing was bears. My grandma loved bears. I had an old country grandma. And we would go to the zoo, she'd just stare at the bears for hours and hours, the brown bears and the black bears. So I thought, let me find the polar bears, grizzly bears. Well, she didn't really know much about the grizzly bears. She just cared that they were brown. Polar bears she wasn't that interested in. They weren't in her frame. Let's do this one. Okay, here we go. Old Bear awoke from his winter sleep. He poked his nose outside his den. What was that smell? Something to eat. Old Bear's empty stomach rumbled. He shook himself all over, then lumbered out of his den to follow the delicious smell. In the back of the village, Booba Brainer took the last potato latke from the pan and put it in the oven with the others. Booba Brainer was 97 years old. She did not hear or see as well as she used to, but she still made the best potato latkes in the village. Every year at Hanukkah time, all her friends came to her house at the edge of the forest. How they loved those latkes. Booba Brainer always made plenty. But on tonight, the first night of Hanukkah, she made twice as many as usual. Tonight was special. Tonight, the rabbi was coming. Booba Brainer hurried to get ready. Just then, she heard a thump on the door. She opened it. Rabbi, you're early. How nice to see you. Growled Old Bear. And happy Hanukkah to you too. Please come in. Old Bear walked into the house. I'll take your coat, Rabbi. My, how thick it is. But the brain is tugged at Old Bear's fur. Old Bear roared. Oh, you want to keep your coat on? Well, that's all right. It is chilly in here. Old Bear's nose twitched. Thank you, Rabbi. How kind of you to say that. The latkes will taste even better than they smell. Old Bear followed his nose to the oven. Rabbi, I'm surprised at you. You don't know. You know that we don't eat until we light the menorah. That's all right. I know you were teasing. I'll light the candles. Will you say the blessings? Booba Brainer struck a match and lit the Shabbos, the servant candle. Then she lit the one for the first night. Old Bear muttered and growled. Shehechiyanu v'kiyamanu v'higiyanu lazman hazeh. Kept us alive, sustained us, and enabled us to reach this season. Oh, Rabbi, you say the blessings so beautifully. Booba Brainer sat down at the table. Old Bear sat beside her. Let's play dreidel. We'll use these nuts. Old Bear cracked one with his teeth. Rabbi, you won't have any nuts for the game if you eat them. Arr, growled old bear. Oh, don't worry. I have plenty of nuts if you need more. Bubba Brainer spun the dreidel and stopped on the letter Gimel. I win! Bubba Brainer swept the nuts into her apron. Arr, old bear growls. Oh, don't be angry, Rabbi. Come on, it's only a game. She tossed him a nut. Old bear begged for more. No, Rabbi, no more nuts. It's time for dinner. Bubba Brain opened the oven door and took out a platter piled high with steaming potato latkes. Old Bear sniffed the latkes as she set them on the table. Rabbi, do you prefer your latkes with applesauce, sour cream, or jam? Ugh, Old Bear grumbled. Jam. I thought so. Bubba Brain smeared five big latkes with jam and stacked them on Old Bear's plate. Old Bear gobbled them down. Bubba Brainer laughed. You should use a fork. You have jam all over your beard. She wet a towel and wiped Old Bear's face. I must tell you, Rabbi, you eat like a bear. Arr! I'm hungry like a bear, so I eat like one. Oh, I can see that, Bubba Brainer said. Old Bear ate and ate until the latkes were gone. He felt sleepy. His head flopped on Bubba Brainer's lap. Rabbi, you're sleepy. Well, who wouldn't be sleepy after such a meal? All the latkes are gone. It's time to go home. But before you leave, I have a Hanukkah present for you. Bubba Brainer took a red scarf from her knitting basket. She wrapped it around Old Bear's neck. I made it myself. Arr! Old Bear licked Bubba Brainer's face. Bubba Brainer blushed. Oh, Rabbi, at my age? Old Bear shuffled to the door. Arr! He growled as he walked off into the night. Good night to you too, Rabbi. Happy Hanukkah. Bubba Brainer was washing dishes when she heard another knock. I wonder who that is. Shalom, Bubba Brainer. All her friends stood at the door wishing her a happy Hanukkah. Shalom, everybody, Bubba Brainer said. Oh, nice to see you. I'm sorry I don't have any more latkes. The rabbi came by. He ate them all. Bubba Brainer, don't you recognize me? Said the rabbi. The rabbi couldn't have eaten all the latkes, everybody said. He's been with us in the synagogue the whole time. Bubba Brainer rubbed her forehead. Something strange is happening, Rabbi. I think there's an imposter going around. He looks like you. He talks like you. He even has your beard. Just then the children cried, look at the floor! Bear track! A bear! And I thought it was the rabbi. Bubba Brainer had to sit down. Soon she began to giggle. That was a very clever bear. Or a very foolish Bubba Brainer. Oh, well, let the bear have a happy Hanukkah. I had a happy Hanukkah, too. And so will you, dear friends. Bring some potatoes from the cellar. Fetch my grater and bowl. Everybody has to help. You too, Rabbi. If we all work together, we'll soon have latkes for everyone. Deep in the forest, Old Bear slumbered in his den. His stomach was full of potato latkes. The warm woolen scarf was wrapped tightly around his neck. Pleasant dreams, Old Bear, and happy Hanukkah.
So I have two readings for you this morning. Actually, just two quotes. So the first one is from Charles Reznikoff. The miracle, of course, was not that the oil for the sacred light in the little cruse lasted as long as they say, but that the courage of the Maccabees lasted to this day. Let that nourish my flickering spirit. And the second quote is from Rabbi Nachum Braverman. We light candles in testament that faith makes miracles possible. So this month, our theme is mystery. And as Eric reported, I asked him about the connections between mystery and Hanukkah, and he said at the time, flat out, there isn't any. And he should know, he's Jewish, and he's written quite a few books on Hanukkah. Still, I kept thinking, isn't there a miracle in the Hanukkah story? Isn't that a mystery? Isn't a miracle a mystery? He calls them fairy tales. Call them miracles, mysteries. So I really love the story of the Maccabees and the beginning of Hanukkah. It's just, in its details, just one of those delicious stories, the ragtag group of good guys with crafty cleverness outwitting the strength of an overpowering empire. It sounds actually like it should be a movie starring Harrison Ford. So we have the king of the great empire insisting that everyone become like him, culturally Greek. And he forbids people within his realm to practice the religion and culture. And for most people, this isn't a big deal, including many Jewish people. However, as Eric told us this morning, a small band of Jewish people emphatically refused. They would not become Greek. They would not worship Greek gods. They had covenanted with their one true God who delivered them out of Egypt, and they would continue to worship that God following the practices of their ancestors. And so they went out into the desert to hide, and they were willing to do that rather than become Greek, and they were willing to take on an empire. So here's what we have, a tiny team without many resources living out in the rocks, in one of the strongest armies in the world. And the conclusion seems quite clear from the beginning, especially if you haven't watched a lot of movies with this particular plot. The empire would win. But no. The ragtag team was led by the crafty, brilliant Judah Maccabee. And so in one scene, the empire's army, who is set to attack this little group of rebels, decides that they're going to set up a surprise attack on them. And Judah knows this. He figures this out. And so while they're coming into place to do the surprise attack, the Maccabees go around and they burn down the army's camp. And so the army never finds them. They come back to camp. They have no tents, no supplies, no horses, and they have to leave. So the king is absolutely furious. He will not be humiliated in this way. So he sends out an even grander army, and this one has elephants in it. And elephants were one of the super weapons of the age. They're hugely powerful and ferocious, and you do not want to be in the way of an attacking elephant. So these elephants would smash down this small band. But Judah ordered his men to attack the elephants handlers. So that's what they went after in this huge army. And the elephants went crazy. They didn't know what to do. They were scared. And they began rampaging, killing the emperor's army. And the soldiers fled in panic. And the Maccabees, in a completely unexpected twist, took back Jerusalem. And that's a pretty great story. It's shocking we don't have several movie versions of it. I don't know. So growing up, however, when I learned about Hanukkah, I would play dreidel with my Jewish friends. Our family had Jewish friends who celebrated Hanukkah. And I would read about Hanukkah and hear about Hanukkah. And that part of the story, this ragtag people who took on the empire, was never what I heard. All I heard was the next part, was when the Jewish people returned to their beloved temple, and it had been polluted, as Eric said, and set up to worship Greek gods. And so when they returned to Jerusalem, they cleaned the temple and they consecrated it back into the worship of their own God. And that's where they celebrated the first Hanukkah. Hanukkah actually means, it turns out, consecration. And the Maccabees wanted to light the temple lamp. And this is a story I think so many of us have heard. And they needed specially consecrated oil. And they found it among the rubble of their temple, just one unopened bottle. Just enough for one night. And since the process to make the consecrated oil was so long, it would take 8 days to make the new oil. still they lit that lamp, and that lamp burned for 8 nights. And it was a miracle, a mystery, a wonder. I was told once that when reading the Bible, to look at the miracles as a big sign saying, pay attention. Pay attention to this bit. It's the important bit. The miracle is the part with the message in it. And over time, the tellers of those stories have created a miracle. It's the important parts to emphasize them so you don't forget it. You don't forget that important piece. So it's important to know that the story of the oil is not in the original biblical books about the Maccabee uprising. In that story, the Maccabees cleaned up the temple and then had an 8-day party, which they called Hanukkah. It is only later in the Talmud, the commentary that the rabbis have on the Hebrew Bible, that the story of the lamps and the lasting oil was first told. So why pay attention to that lasting oil? Why attach that particular miracle to the story of the Maccabees and just keep on telling that story every year over centuries? It seems the point may be to pay attention to what lasts well beyond what it should. In this story, that is the Maccabees. How had they persevered during their battle with the empire? How did they last? Somehow they kept going, long past when you might ordinarily expect. Why was that? Some of that was, of course, Judah Maccabee's particular genius. And some was a bit of luck. And there was more, though. And perhaps this is what the lasting oil points to. The Maccabees were religious traditionalists. And I think, as Eric pointed out later, they changed their minds about that. But at first they were. And they believed that the Jewish people needed to practice their faith exactly as it had been passed down to them. They should not eat pork, for example, and they must circumcise their boys. They must not work on the Sabbath. And in fact, they believed that so strongly that once they were attacked on the Sabbath, and they would not fight back. And they lost 1,000 men, women, and children. But at the time, I think as Eric told us, there were Jews that did not agree with the Maccabees. They felt like it was fine to modernize. They wanted to be part of the culturally Greek society. They were more wealthy, socially elite Jews. And they had a lot resting on becoming like everyone else. Some were even willing to go through an operation that reversed circumcision. I can't really imagine that, but that's what they did. And so when they went to the gym, they would not be seen as Jews. And for the traditional Jews, this was absolute blasphemy. Indeed, the first death in the fight was of a Hellenized Jew who was killed by the patriarch of the Maccabees, which started the Maccabee Rebellion, for betraying their faith. Today's scholars and rabbis argue about whether the Maccabees were fanatics, like today's Taliban, or more close to home, some very conservative Christians, people who are not fighting just for religious freedom, but for the power to insist that everyone else follows their values or faith. And there is evidence for this. The Maccabees really did kill and harass Jewish people who were not following their faith as they thought it should be practiced. And when they came into power, as Eric told us this morning, they forced people to convert. They circumcised people against their wills. However, others are not quite as convinced by this understanding of the story. The Maccabees really were faithful Jews. And the king told the Jewish people they had to stop practicing the important tenets of their faith. And the Maccabees revolted. This, they say, is clearly a story of religious freedom. Well, the Maccabees were horrified by the Jews behaving as Greeks. They could never have imagined that they would one day take Jerusalem and have the power to enforce the rules of their faith. So that is all of the scholarly information and argument about the Maccabees. But what does the miracle of the lasting oil suggest to us, non-scholars, but faithful people? What is the mystery in the story? What never failed? What light never went out? Well, the commitment of the Maccabees never went out. The cohesiveness of the Jewish people across continents and centuries never went out. And there is a mystery in that. How did these things come to pass? As rationalists, it is easy for us to brush off the miracle of the oil as a fun story, as fiction, as fairy tale, as Eric says. The sustained existence and power of the Maccabees and the Jewish people is not fiction. Why didn't their light go out? I believe this is an important question that the Hanukkah story asks us to ponder. And I believe one of the answers to that is commitment. The Maccabees were absolutely committed. They were in 100%. They did not waver in their commitment that they would live their faith as it was taught to them. And the story of the Jewish people is no different. They have been committed to their communities and faith in all sorts of places where they could have easily been pulled away by fear of persecution or the seduction of being like everyone else. And that is the miracle of the Days of Light, committed people who sustained their efforts long past imagining. Thinking about this story makes me wonder about Unitarian Universalists. Do we have such a commitment to our faith? Would we perish easily under the insistence of a king that we not gather together, that we do not speak or print our principles or live our values? I have no doubt that the traditionalist views of the Maccabees helped them commit. If you believe you are right and that the fate of your soul and your relationship with the divine is at stake, commitment seems very obvious and very clear. However, if you are open to many and changing truths, such commitment does not seem as clear. James Luther Adams, a Unitarian Universalist and a great liberal social ethicist of the mid-20th century, felt that the great weakness of our faith was our lack of commitment. He argued, and I believe he was right, that a commitment is something that shifts you. When you commit, you live differently than you did before. Commitment shifts how you structure and think about your life. Significant commitments happen when we marry or have a child or take on a new responsibility. It is so easy to see how your life shifts when you make a commitment to a child, for example. How you prioritize your life, what you do every day, changes. And this is even true of smaller commitments. For example, I remember when I committed to going to church. For a long time, I got up on Sundays and said, do I feel like going? And if I didn't, I didn't go. At some point, I shifted, though, and I committed. At that point, I no longer asked myself if I felt like going. I simply went every Sunday, unless I was sick or away. My life priorities, the way I lived it and thought about it, had changed. Many faiths require significant commitment of their people. Unitarian Universalism is a values faith, not the belief and practice faith of the Maccabees. For the Maccabees, the commitment, what it was and how you lived, was clearer than it is in a faith like ours. The king said, you shall not circumcise your sons. And for them, that was worth fighting for. It was worth fleeing to the desert. It was worth fighting an empire. They knew what their commitment was, and they knew when the line had been crossed. With a values faith, this is so much less clear. And we are also a liberal faith, meaning we value religious freedom and are comfortable bringing the changing norms and understanding of our society and culture into our tradition. We change fairly easily. So what would it mean to fight for our faith? Is there anything that would cause us to say no to an empire and mean it so much that we would hold on long past when the oil should have burned out? The truth is, the values of our faith, the ones stated in our principles, the ones we believe in most deeply, are violated every single day. For example, our government, with our tax dollars, violates the inherent worth and dignity of people at our border and in for-profit detention centers every day. People are frozen with air conditioners. They are fed miserably. They live in unsanitary conditions and are not given medical treatment. Daily, our government creates policies that increase carbon gases, while at the same moment, scientists issue dire warnings about climate and the need to stop carbon now, today. And we all feel terrible about these things. Of course we do. And many of us really take action to stop them. We do this in practices that we have, in time commitments, in letters and calls, in our two-minute actions downstairs. But does our faith call us to make the same types of commitments that the Maccabees made? To me, it seems as religious liberal much more challenging to make those kinds of commitments. When truth is open, when values are effuse and large, and we see everything gray and weighted with complexity, that kind of commitment just seems more challenging to make. And what would it look like to make such a commitment? How would our lives shift? Is our faith capable of bringing out those commitments out of our beings? I actually don't know that. But the story of the Maccabees and the lamp oil that burned for 8 days has made me mull that question. And part of in my mulling, I have realized that Unitarian Universalists have changed the world through our commitments before. This morning, Eric talked about the way there were two real miracles, two important things in the story of Hanukkah. And one was the fact that the Jewish people have survived. And the other was that Jesus, nobody changed the way we think and live in the world and changed the course of history. And this has been true of Unitarian Universalism also. And we have always been a ragtag team, incredibly small in number. But we brought into thought and experience that people can directly experience the holy without intervention from the church. That was through transcendentalism. And that is something largely believed today. We also brought into thought and experience the idea that God is good and people don't have to fear burning in hell. And that is also a really common understanding of God for those who believe in God to this day. And we brought into thought and experience the humanist idea that you don't need God to live ethical and good lives, which was really radical at the time and something that is largely believed in our communities and in secular society. We also brought, and this is a whole other sermon, some of you have heard it, we also brought into our own celebration this holiday season, the way Americans and people all across the world celebrate Christmas. This way that we celebrate Christmas was brought to us by Unitarians, the trees and the gifts and the peace and the goodwill to all. That was us. We are a ragtag team that has changed culture in many ways. We are small and we are few, just as the Maccabees were, just as Jesus and his little team were, just as we have been in our fast past. And we have brought freedom and peace to everyone. Our values, our principal values, matter more now than they ever have. We believe firmly, our foundational values are the inherent worth and dignity of every single person and the care and feeding of the interdependent web that makes our life and all life possible. Our world needs to experience our values as living, as present, as important. So the question is, what commitments do we need to make this possible now? How does the ragtag team of Unitarian Universalists shift the world again the way it needs to be shifted? I think that's the question for us this Hanukkah season.